Today on Pilgrim Radio's His People, Ivan Mesa on cultural apologetics.
But I think, you know, there's a new generation of apologists who are also drawing attention to the beautiful, that longing for beauty in the world that God has made. And I think that's one way that we get to engage our unbelieving neighbors.
Ivan Mesa, next. In a nutshell, cultural apologetics aims to bridge the gap between the gospel and contemporary culture. Its goal is to make Christianity not only believable, but desirable. To find out more, Spencer Dahlke contacted Ivan Mesa, a writer with the Gospel Coalition, to talk about the new book he's co-written with Colin Hansen and Skylar Flowers titled The Gospel After Christendom, an introduction to cultural apologetics.
What prompted the publishing of this book?
I think one simple thing is we at TGC care a lot about the topic of cultural apologetics. I mean, briefly defined, it's a way to diagnose what is in this cultural moment. What are the desires, aspirations, what are the longings of the heart of the culture that we're trying to reach with the gospel, and engage that in a way that's representative of what they believe, and see how ultimately that longing, for whether it's for truth or for justice, for freedom, ultimately points to the Lord. And so we at TGC, we exist to resource the church. And so in 2023, we started a center called the Keller Center for Cultural Apologetics. And so, as you may gather, that's named after one of our co-founders, Tim Keller, who died in 2023 as well. And so we named the center after him. And this book is a gathering of a number of our fellows that are part of that center that really model what we're trying to encourage more of in the church today when it comes to reaching the culture with the gospel of Christ.
I understand that this book draws very heavily from, as you said, Tim Keller's approach to evangelism. How did his influence, I guess, shape your vision for the project, and what lessons from him stood out in this book?
I had the privilege of meeting Tim along with other TGC staffers over the last few years before he died. The last time we met with him was in 2019. And we met with him in his New York City office of Redeemer City to City to really talk about this topic of ways to navigate this cultural moment, kind of figure out where our culture is standing, what are those longings, like I just said, those aspirations of the culture, and trying to, yeah, really come into those conversations, and whether they be in New York City or in Augusta, Georgia, or in Los Angeles or in Paris, wherever it might be, and really make the gospel clear. And so that was, I think, Tim's heartbeat for ministry in terms of apologetically engaging the culture. It's not to water down the gospel, but to make the offense of the gospel really clear. Sometimes, especially in a post-Christendom culture, a lot of the unbelievers that we navigate with, that we talk to in our offices, they really don't have the same, you know, shared dictionary when it comes to knowing the Bible, knowing what sin is, knowing what the gospel is. And so working backward a little bit, taking a few steps back and doing a little bit of a, you know, pre-evangelism, explaining some of these concepts to those that we're trying to reach with the good news of Christ. And so, yeah, Tim's ministry at TGC is very significant. And especially with the Keller Center for Cultural Apologetics, and this book project, the DNA is all over it.
You mentioned the cultural shift away from our Christian roots affecting what people understand about, you know, we've kind of lost the shared terminology. Would you care to enlighten us, like, a few examples of, like, what is it that we've lost? What are some of these terms?
I think the classic one is just sin. And so I think sometimes in recent years before Tim died, he would be criticized by, you know, for saying you're not speaking enough about sin. You know, if you go back to Tim's sermons back even early 90s, he talked a lot about idolatry as a way to talk about sin. Of course, idolatry is replete all over the Old and New Testament as a way to think about the nature of sin, how it is placing, instead of God, something. It could be even a good thing. Entertainment, sex, good gifts that the Lord gives to us as his creatures, and yet we twist that and we make an idol of it in place of God. And so the way that Tim would talk about idolatry was never to soft pedal sin and not talk about sin, but to really emphasize the serious nature of sin as being really high treason against God. So that would be one example where sometimes when you throw out words like sin, as Christians, that is a shared vocabulary. But for somebody who never grew up in the church, has never really engaged the Bible, there are all manner of things that you can put into that bucket that may or may not be truth. And so that's, I think, one of the key things that we're trying to do in this project also is to model really good engagement with the culture so that we can hear what they're saying and say, oh, yeah, that's not exactly what I mean by that. And that would be one example of sin versus idolatry.
By cultural apologetics, it sounded to me like you were defining that in terms of pinpointing, like you said, what is it, rather than seeing like, what does our culture not understand, asking rather like, what does our culture want? I really liked the explanation of how we reason too. I think your fellow co-editor, Colin Hansen, wrote in the introduction. Would you care to explain the illustration he used? He described it like an elephant and its rider.
That must be a reference to Jonathan Haidt.
That sounds right.
Okay. The way that Jonathan Haidt uses the elephant and the rider illustration is we all like to think that we are these rational beings. We think ourselves to certain viewpoints. Jonathan Haidt is a sociologist. I think he's a secular Jew, not a Christian. And so he's just coming at this from a kind of sociological perspective. And he's observing that so often, whether from the right or from the left, on a variety of issues, we all like to think we are just sitting down making these rational connections from point A to point B to point C, including our moral decisions. And I think he perceptively highlights the fact that, no, I think rather than, you know, you are the rider, the, you know, intelligence, rational thinking, leading the elephant, the emotions, the intuitive side of who you are, it's really the elephant that is guiding the rider. And so I think one of the times that Tim really got into trouble for this was he would use this illustration of, you know, a young man coming up to him saying, Pastor Tim, I'm really struggling with the Christian morality and why this is, you know, viewed as sin, and I'm struggling with unbelief and questioning my salvation. And Tim at one point said, who are you sleeping with? I think what Tim was getting at, sometimes we all like to think that we are just pure intellectual brains on a stick, and we're just having these intellectual doubts about God. But sometimes what can inform, lead to that questioning of our thoughts is really moral decisions. We want to live in a certain way. We want to justify our sin. And then working backward from that, we try to rationalize. So the fancy kind of logical category would be making post hoc rationalizations for whatever we want. And so that is not maybe the end all be all in terms of these conversations, but I think it rightly points to some dynamic that happens among Christians and non-Christians alike. We are more than we care to admit at times, driven not so much by the intellect, but also by our desires. And I think Tim was really dependent on a number of figures, including St. Augustine, in terms of ordered affections. Again, we are truly intellectual beings. We are also affective beings who love. And that's why Christ doesn't just merely want our heads. He wants our hearts and our hands to live out in faithfulness to him. So that's kind of, I think, what that sociologist is drawing attention to.
Did you guys ever like consider Jonathan Edwards too? I think he wrote an essay.
Yes.
About religious affections.
Well, and that another key influence there that I was thinking of with Keller in specifics there, because he would often, Edwards would talk about honey. It's one thing to know that honey is sweet. It's another thing to know that, actually taste that honey is sweet, to know that, not just know. And so, yeah, I think that is a key emphasis there, where I think there's an Edwardsian flavor that really ministered to Tim, and I think you'll see versions of that in this book. So we have maybe three chapters that come to mind about the good, the true, and the beautiful. I think sometimes for Christians, especially in apologetic conversations, it's easy to just camp on the truth. We just need to make rational arguments, classical apologetics, and I think that is a good conversation to be had about the existence of the world and where does morality come from, and I think that's an important conversation. But I think, you know, there's a new generation of apologists who are also drawing attention to the beautiful, that longing for beauty in the world that God has made, and I think that's one way that we get to engage our unbelieving neighbors.
thinking about apologetics in terms of what do people want? And then I think you write about like showing how Christ fulfills those longings. What do you think our culture wants?
Great question. So, I mean, we can just spend the entire time on this, right? I mean, we at TGC, we're even doing a whole series. There's a curriculum called Making Sense of Us. And for those who are listeners who know Tim Keller's book, Making Sense of God, there's a homage there even in that title for that project. But whether it's freedom or justice or identity, I mean, we can just camp on any of these. But I think, I mean, let's just pick identity. Right now, the big conversation in our current cultural moment is identity. What is your identity? How do you define your identity? We can go the conversation toward gender. We can talk about identity. Who do I say that I am? I think the reality in our current moment is I get to define who I am from within myself. I define who I am. And you see this in all the, you know, latest Pixar movies and Disney. You can quote, let it go, let it go. No one can hold you back, tell you what to do or not to do or who to be or who to be with. And so identity is a big topic that our culture longs for, to find meaning and purpose, formation, being accepted because of your identity. And of course, Christians, we have a lot to say about identity. Ultimately, our identity does not come from within ourselves. It comes from outside of ourselves. God has formed us in His image to glorify Him. We don't get to define our identity. He already defines our identity. And of course, if we are in Christ, that is our ultimate identity. The New Testament language of in Christ, our union with Christ, I think is of paramount significance here to be thinking through. And so that would be one example, identity, where I think there's an opportunity to engage the culture, but also as Christians in terms of discipleship, growing in Christ, reminding even ourselves of our true identity is not our background. It's not our group. It's not our race. It's not our ethnicity. Those are all things that are part of our story, but they are not fundamentally who we are, and that is in Christ.
My guest today is Ivan Mesa. He's the editorial director for the Gospel Coalition. We're discussing a book he helped to edit, The Gospel After Christendom, An Introduction to Cultural Apologetics, looking at our culture, wanting identity, maybe like you mentioned in the last answer. If church life could be reformed to better implement, you know, the insights in this book and to pursue cultural apologetics and showing the culture the life that they are looking for but are not finding because they're trying to find it outside of Christ, how do you think the church could start implementing that?
I think very simply listening. In some of these conversations, they can get a little bit too abstract. You might feel the pressure that you have to read every secular book to kind of identify and pinpoint some of these cultural narratives. And I think there's a place for that. And I think Tim even modeled that himself really well in terms of keeping up to date with non-Christian books about these topics that we've been talking about. But I think pastorally, what really influenced him and what we're trying to model at the Keller Center is a posture of listening to those around us. So sometimes in, you know, when you ask about church, I think just practically speaking, for whether it's a pastor or just a lay person in the church, having really good conversations with unbelievers around you, taking opportunities to listen. What are the worldviews that are coming out of their mouths? What are the longings of their heart? I think asking what gives meaning to their existence, what brings them joy, or morality. How do you define morality? What are you living for? What it gives you that identity? So I think there's more ways to have kind of highbrow conversations about this. But in terms of brass tacks, like where the rubber meets the road, the reality is, I mean, I would just say in order to have right answers, we first have to listen well to what they're saying and then use those conversations as a way to eventually point them to that ultimate source, that longing of their hearts that they have for Christ.
I understand also that storytelling is one approach. Once we have listened, of course, share the gospel with people by telling stories. I mean, this has been a, no doubt, should we say, a rhetorical technique for however many years. How could the church implement storytelling in its evangelism?
I think the point is we already have a story that we are part of. If you don't know your story, that leads to all manner of consequences that are not good for society. And so the good news is we as Christians have an epic story, the story of all stories. I mean, one of the many reasons I love C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien is because they were steeped in a Christian worldview that was really, we make sense of ourselves in a story. I mean, from the moment that you're born and raised in a family, there are stories that you're inheriting from your family, tall tales of generations before you, your parents, your grandparents, your great-grandparents who came from another country or did X, Y, Z, and then the funny, humorous stories. So I think we are all instinctively narrative creatures who long for and identify with certain stories. And if that's true at a micro level, I think it's even more true at a macro level in terms of Christians. And so we Christians, you just think about the Bible. There's a narrative arc from Genesis to Revelation. History is not this mistake or this circular reasoning. It's not this indifferent. I mean, there is a point to history from beginning to middle to end, from God's creation to Jesus dying on the cross for sinners, to his ultimate consummation at the end of the ages. And we are part of that story. We're part of the larger history of the church. I mean, I'm a church historian by training, so I love thinking about church history. And that is part of our story that I get kind of baptized into when I became a Christian. These are my brothers and sisters in glory that I get to study and learn from. So I think, yeah, in terms of the everyday Christian experience, We all long for stories. We create stories because we're made in God's image as the greatest storyteller of all. Even in the way that we talk about the gospel, there is a narrative component to that story that makes sense of everything in our lives from beginning to end.
As a thespian at heart, personally, I would love to ask, like, how do you think the stage could be used by Christians to show people this is what you want? You need to find it in Jesus.
I am not an expert on that field, but mm-hmm. I would say as a inveterate lover of the arts, I mean, I love musical performances and all that. Of course, like I said, I love C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien. I mean, I think there's a lot of freedom for Christians in kind of different media environments to take up their creative gifts. I mean, you think about in the Old Testament, God giving gifts to, who are the names? Bezalel, and I forget the other priests, in terms of the tabernacle, the artistry, the embroidery. So I think even kind of tying this back to our previous discussion about truth, goodness, and beauty, I think that's an aspect that many evangelicals maybe don't give a lot of thought to, is connecting the dots between what we think, what our theology is, and having a theology of beauty, a theology of the arts. So I think there's a lot of freedom for Christians in different areas, whether it's film, TV shows, music, the stage. I mean, I'm all for that. Creating stories that tell true stories about what is true, what is good, and what is beautiful.
We talk about what culture wants, finding our deepest desires met in ultimately in Christ. First and foremost, and ultimately, a lot of things I've been thinking about recently is like how we flourish as human beings. What do we mean by human flourishing? So let me put that question to you. Like, what do you think we mean when we talk about human flourishing, and how can Christians take that into account maybe when they're engaging with unbelievers?
In terms of flourishing, I think you can go in a different direction here. One would be just be common grace. I think the reality is God created the world with grace abounding already in it. The reality is post Genesis 3, the world, even though marred by sin, is not the worst that it can be. And so there's a measure of God's grace that still remains. And praise be to God. I mean, we have law enforcement, we have laws of the land. We can be grateful for common grace that preserves order, preserves goodness, thwarts evil. And I think that is one aspect of this conversation when it comes to human flourishing, that we should be grateful for common grace as a category, even among unbelievers. I mean, you even mentioned the arts right now. I mean, how many unbelievers have created works of art, whether in book form, playwrights, films, portraits, that embody human flourishing at its best, even if they are not themselves Christians? And I think that's just one aspect there that I think is really relevant. One of our desires for believers is to tell others who are not Christians, ultimately point them to Christ as the true source of ultimate human flourishing. in all that I said about common grace, I think if we just stopped there, that would not be sufficient, right? Ultimately, we want human flourishing to culminate in unbelievers to know Christ, to flourish both in this life and in the life to come. So if we just have a this life human flourishing point to make, then I think that's just short-sighted. We want human flourishing to outlast this life. Everything that's true, everything that's good, everything that's beautiful in this world ultimately finds its fulfillment in Christ in the new heavens and the new earth. And so that's why, again, our longing, even in this book project, is evangelistic in heart. We want people to know Christ, to know the forgiveness of sins, to know what it means to walk in fellowship with God, to be part of His church. That's a key emphasis for us at TGC, is not just to make Christians, but to see Christians that are part of a community. And so if you want to talk about flourishing, that is a key way that those now accepted by God through Christ are now part of His church and really embody human flourishing at its best within the context of a covenant community who love God.
You know, American culture has seen something of a return to Christianity, especially among young men. How do you think this book can build on this encouraging trend?
The things that you're highlighting there in terms of there is a yearning and interest even among Gen Z, particularly, as you said, with young men, that's super encouraging. For all the things that are the trends that are maybe discouraging or sobering, I think God is at work. And so that gives me renewed joy and gratitude for what God is doing. And so, yeah, our longing again in this book is to have this evangelistic component. And so our prayer is that this would be a helpful resource for young men, younger women, older men, older women. We can have conversations that are at the political level. We can have conversations that are at the cultural level. And those are important conversations that Christians are going to have. But fundamentally, at the root of all these different issues that we're facing as a society are spiritual elements, spiritual conversations that need to be taking place. And so I'm really encouraged by these small tastes of revival that I see, even going a few years ago with revivals breaking out at Asbury University or even at Wheaton College. And I'm praying that God would awaken His people. And so this is not a time to backtrack, not a time to be on the defensive or on the back heel, but to really lean in and engage. I think there is a hunger and a yearning, particularly among young men, but the Gen Z cohort, maybe because of they're tired of the primary digital life, maybe it's that, or just the hollowness of modern society with very few legit answers that address the longings of their heart. I'm not sure all that's going on there, but we as a church have the opportunity to kind of in that breach really come in and point ultimately to Christ as the longing fulfillment of all that they're really wanting.
Is there anything else about this book that I haven't asked about? You know, important tidbits, interesting insights, things like this that you'd like to draw out?
One of the key emphases that we talk about at TGC is the distinction between the weather and climate. And so it's easy to just pick up on, you know, what's the weather? What is the cause du jour of the day? What is the most controversial thing that got published at the New York Times? Or what is the controversy of the day that should really, you know, outrage us? And not to belittle any of those things, but sometimes it's easy to just merely stay at that level. And one of the things that we love to do at TGC is elevate the conversations beyond just the weather report on a daily basis, but really look at the overall climate. What are those larger issues, those trends in society that are really leading to the different issues that we have day to day? If you want to change the metaphor, you can, if you're in the ocean, you can just focus on the sea waves and all that, or you can go down into the ocean, or you can go down to the tectonic plates. And we at TGC really want to focus on those deeper subterranean issues that we've been talking about this in this conversation that really feed and fuel all these different things that are just happening in the larger culture. So that'd be one thing that just as a way to engage this book, I would encourage people to pick up the book and engage with that mindset.
You've been listening to His People on Pilgrim Radio. Many thanks to our guest, Ivan Mesa, co-author along with Colin Hansen and Skylar Flowers of the new book, The Gospel After Christendom, An Introduction to Cultural Apologetics. Coming up on tomorrow's program, it's Rhonda Velez on cultivating joy in the seasons God says no.
And so I think sometimes we get so caught up in the, like, well, God said no, and no, I'm believing for it, and I want a miracle, and all these things. But sometimes, like, the no is really from a place of, like, I love you so much. I can't give you this, because if I give you this, it will harm you.
That's tomorrow at the same time right here on His People. Thanks for listening.